From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. An American convicted of a federal crime is 7% more likely to be sentenced to jail time if they are Black than if they are white. And that jail time is likely to be 8 months longer if the person is Black. That's a major disparity, but it's also a major improvement over where we were 20 years ago. That's the conclusion of a new analysis presented at the American Sociological Association earlier this month. Ryan King is professor and chair of sociology at The Ohio State University and one of the lead authors on this work. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What was your hypothesis going into this research? Did you have some reason to expect that perhaps disparities in sentencing had actually improved?
No, actually, we did not. We didn't know quite what to expect coming into this. And in fact, in conversations with my co-author, Mike Light from the University of Wisconsin, we had come up with a number of reasons why we might expect disparities to actually have increased and some reasons why we thought it might have decreased. And so that's why we decided to collect as much information as we could and do the analysis to try to sort it out.
What are some of those reasons that you were looking at going into this study?
Sure. I can give you maybe just three examples from each column here. So in terms of reasons why we might expect less disparity, for one, there's been some attenuation or some decrease in overt racial discrimination over time. If we look, for example, at the General Social Survey, those who support segregationist policies, those who are opposed to interracial marriage, those numbers have declined over time. And by over time, I mean since about the 1970s or so. Second, there's been more diversity in the legal profession, and research shows that when you have more diversity in a workplace or more diversity in the courtroom work group, you tend to get more equality in sentencing. And then third, there had been some policy changes, particularly at the federal level in 2009, 2010, that may have led to a reduction in disparities. On the other side, there were some reasons to expect more. Some prior research on related topics, such as racial disparities and the imprisonment rate, had suggested since that time that it had increased. There are some social science theories that suggest as a society gets more diverse, you tend to get more discrimination. And then there's the issue of criminal histories, that since the 1980s or so, that the average defendant coming into a criminal court has a more extensive criminal history or criminal record, and that's particularly true for African Americans relative to whites. So given that that's an important determinant of whether you go to prison or not, those factors led us to believe, well, maybe it had increased. And so in the end, we found that it had actually decreased, in some cases substantially.
So Ryan King, take us back to the early 1990s. That's when your new analysis kind of starts. That's the baseline that you compare to. So where were we then in terms of racial disparities in sentencing?
Right. So we start in the 1990s in our analyses of federal courts, those who were convicted in a federal court. And in some of our other analyses, we look at one state, for example, Minnesota, where we start in the early 1980s. But to your question with respect to federal courts, the difference in the average sentences between whites and blacks was quite substantial in U.S. district courts. So, for example, without taking into account the nature of the crime or the criminal history, things that ultimately matter and that we did take into account in some analyses, but that the average sentence for blacks in federal court was right around 70 months, whereas for whites it was closer to 40 months. And so you had a disparity of about 30 months in 1992.
That's almost 3 years difference.
Right, and that was not even the peak. The peak was a couple of years later where it was north of 40 months. And it stayed north of that 30-month mark until about 2009, when we saw a rather stark decline over the following 8 years or so. And by 2016, the last data point in our analysis, it was, as you mentioned earlier, below 10 months.
That's a pretty significant change, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely, I would say.
So how do those sentences then, we're talking about the difference in the number of months that a white person versus a black person would be sentenced to when they've been convicted of a federal crime, how do those sentence lengths compare to, say, the federal guidelines for sentencing?
Pretty good, pretty good, right? So the United States courts operate under a guideline system, which means, in brief, that two factors should really determine most of the criminal sentence, and that is the severity of the crime and the criminal history of the defendant. And so our analysis finds that, by and large, right, those disparities were driven not so much by judges using a lot of discretion and sentencing blacks more harshly than whites, but it was driven more by the guidelines themselves. That is, the actual sentences and the actual difference that we see between blacks and whites in federal courts maps on very closely to what we would expect given the guidelines, or what's called the presumptive sentence that the guidelines recommend.
Does that then suggest that the disparity is, in fact, not a disparity in how much jail time a person is being sentenced to for a specific crime, but that, in fact, black and white Americans are being charged with and convicted of different crimes?
Yeah, it's largely attributable to the latter. Not only, though, the type of crime, but also the criminal history of the defendant. On average, black criminal defendants who are convicted in federal court have more extensive criminal histories than the average white in criminal court, and that's something we find at the state level as well. It's those factors in the presumptive sentence that generates that's driving the disparity.
Ryan King, in this analysis, you have also looked at sentencing disparities between white and Hispanic individuals, and the overall disparity in the likelihood of being incarcerated has actually increased for Hispanics between 1996 and 2016. But the full story is much more nuanced than that and comes down to an issue not necessarily of race, but of citizenship. So tell us what you found there.
The story for the black-white difference was pretty clean, and we felt like we could explain pretty well why that decline had happened. It's much more complicated when we compared Hispanic convicted defendants to white convicted defendants in federal court there. And the key thing that we have to keep in mind there is whether or not the defendant was a citizen or a non-citizen. And so that takes us in two different directions. For non-citizens, our research finds that the gap between citizen and non-citizen has been growing over time. On the other hand, if we look only at U.S. citizens, we find that the sentencing disparities have declined over time, where the gap is much more narrow today than it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Is this another instance where the nature of the crime, the charge, is actually responsible for that disparity? I mean, is this the difference between sentencing and incarceration for immigration offenses versus other offenses? Or is this a story of discrimination against non-citizens when they're charged with the same crimes as citizens?
It's a little bit of both. So if you take the big picture and you look at sentencing, yeah, it's still the nature of the crime that's going to drive a lot of this. And so if we look at the same criminal offense and the same criminal record, and we compare citizens to non-citizens, we still find some residual difference there, in which non-citizens are on average sentenced more harshly than our citizens, even for the same crime and controlling for the criminal record. And that disparity has grown over time. Meanwhile, or at the same time, for Hispanic citizens, they have come closer to white citizens during that same time period.
Ryan, you mentioned going into this work that you had kind of these two lists of factors that could increase racial disparities in sentencing and factors that could have decreased racial disparities in criminal sentencing over this 20 or 30 year period that you were looking at. Now that you actually have the data and the analysis, that you know what the trends are, where disparities are decreasing and what's driving those changes, does that give you any sense of why, what might actually be leading to those changes?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. And in particular, in the federal system, as we talked about earlier, you know, the sentencing differences were pretty drastic up until, you know, about, I mentioned the date 2009 or so. And it's probably not coincidence that two things happen that affect federal charging and sentencing. around that time. The first is you have a change in the presidential administration. You have the first African-American attorney general in Eric Holder. And there's a different take on mandatory minimums and drug charging in federal court. 1 year later in 2010, Congress passes the Fair Sentencing Act, and that gets incorporated into the sentencing guidelines the next year in 2011. And the Fair Sentencing Act is quite important because many of us have heard of the infamous 100-to-1 powder to or crack to powder cocaine ratio, and that this was a drug law passed in 1986 that basically punished crack cocaine possession 100 times more harshly than powder cocaine possession. And the Fair Sentencing Act brought that 100-to-1 difference down to 18-to-1. And so we think it's probably not coincidence that right in 2010 that you see almost all of the decrease in sentencing disparities, particularly for drug cases, happen in the 5 or 10 years following that legal change and that change in the administration.
Ryan King, as you yourself have noted, even if we were to just say look at the dramatic reduction in the disparity between jail time sentences for Black versus white Americans and say that's a huge improvement, improvement does not mean that we have reached equality or fixed the problems in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, and I want to be very careful to point that out, and I appreciate you mentioning that, because the point of our research is not to say, look, everything's equal now, don't worry about it anymore. Rather, we just wanted to describe the change over as long a period of time as we could. There's not perfect equality in sentencing, and we are not yet at parity, and so there's still work to be done.
Ryan King is professor and chair of sociology at The Ohio State University. He is the co-author of a recent analysis of changes in sentencing disparities for Black, white, and Hispanic Americans. Ryan, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, the public health impacts of Hurricane Harvey, from chemical exposures to stress. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's been just over 2 years since Hurricane Harvey devastated the Houston area, dumping up to 5 feet of rain in some places and causing unprecedented flooding. Tens of thousands of people were displaced. Hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses were destroyed. Now, researchers have gathered at Baylor College of Medicine to share what they've learned about the public health impacts of Hurricane Harvey. Melissa Bondi is professor of epidemiology and population sciences at Baylor College of Medicine, and she organized that event. Melissa, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Melissa, at the time when Hurricane Harvey hit, we heard a lot about the possibility that mixed into those floodwaters might be all sorts of toxic chemicals coming from roads, coming from businesses, coming from all sorts of different places. 2 years later, what do we know about the chemicals that Houston residents may have been exposed to as a result of Hurricane Harvey?
So we were concerned too, and at Baylor College of Medicine, we took it upon ourselves to try to understand what those exposures could be. So what we did, which was really interesting, is we went to some of those kinds of areas that you're mentioning. One of them is where there are chemical exposures because they're close to the ship channel. People reside near the ship channel. They also reside in areas where there could be Superfund sites. We also went to another area called Attics area, where they released the water so that the flooding wouldn't occur downstream, which would have been the whole downtown of Houston. And so the Army Corps of Engineers decided that they would release those waters. And many people were flooded with, 15 or more inches of water in their homes. And so we weren't sure what kinds of exposures they had. So we launched this study, and we worked closely with a group in the Oregon State University, Dr. Kim Anderson, who has designed a very simple passive, like a wristband, kind of like the Livestrong rubber silicon wristbands, where we were able to ask the participants to wear the wristband for 7 days. And then basically what the technology, it's a GC mass spec, which takes, pulls the chemicals that the person could have been exposed to. They leave it on during, while they're bathing, they leave it on for the complete 7 days, and they're able to look at about 1,500 different chemicals of all different types, including caffeine, tobacco smoke, any kinds of pesticides. I mean, so it's a whole gamut of about 1,500 different types of chemicals they could be exposed to.
And of those 1,500 different chemicals, how many did you see in Houston residents?
So we've only have the results for the first time point. So what we did is we went out into the field within 30 days after the hurricane. We went into these different communities that I mentioned, and we recruited people and asked them to wear the wristbands. And then a year later, we went back into the community. So we surveyed the people that we could again, and then we also asked other people who we didn't recruit if they wanted to participate. And so we have two time points. We have, you know, at 30 days at baseline, and then 1 year later. So we have data right now for the first time point. And it's interesting because we found different exposures in different areas, which we would have expected. And there were some common things. So there was exposures to what we call xenoestrogens, which are things that result from plastics. And that's the part that I'm really not sure about whether or not we'd still identify those today. I mean, people drink out of plastic bottles, which means that they're, you know, constantly having exposures to BPAs and to those types of chemicals that are in plastics in particular. We didn't find any pesticide exposures that we had anticipated there could be. But we did find different types of exposures that people had. And I think we identified maybe the most, some people were exposed to 40 different, you know, we were able to identify maybe 40 different chemicals in some of the people.
I mean, obviously, we're all exposed to hundreds of chemicals every day, even when we haven't just been hit by catastrophic flooding. It's interesting that one of the chemicals that stands, or the class of chemicals that stands out most to you, might be linked actually to the practice of drinking bottled water, whether
right.
that's in the course of everyday life or perhaps, you know, drinking more bottled water in the wake of a disaster, not necessarily because of anything that was in those floodwaters.
Exactly. And that's what concerns me is that, you know, do we know what those types of health exposures could be long term? Because we asked people to wear it while they showered. And so there was a lot of personal care product exposures and things like that. So in terms of what could be, you know, specific exposures, we're not sure. We're correlating those data with some of the questionnaire data as well as some of the floodwater information. So we know how much water was in the person's home. You know, when we look at that data, we see that what's really of concern to most of these people is the level of stress and how much effect that had on these individuals. So that's the thing that really concerns me is how do we deal with this in the future? Because we know that every time it rains, people have PTSD because they keep thinking about what it was like for them when the rains came and when the floods hit. And for some communities that we included, they had multiple flooding. I mean, there's one community that had, like in the last 5 years, they've had four different flooding events that have been pretty devastating. And I think Harvey was just like the icing on the cake for many, because how many more floodings can you have in your home and have to deal with that? So we know that the stress level is really significant.
So potential chemical exposures from drinking bottled water, the psychological impact of stress, of trauma from the event. And then Melissa Bondi, also related to flooding of homes, is the concern about the risk of mold in those homes. What have we learned so far about that?
Exactly. And that's why we did microbiome. So we also included in our study where we took samples, personal samples. So we asked for a sample where they swabbed their nose so that we could identify the microbiome in their nose. We asked them to spit. We also had the individuals take a swab and swab the inside of their home so that we could look at the amount of mold that could have been growing in their homes, because that's definitely a concern. So we're just finishing those analyses and trying trying to correlate that also with other exposures. We know that respiratory infections and allergies have been also common in these individuals, and so we're looking at the types of bacteria, the types of mold that could interact with that. There's a lot of data that we collected, and trying to analyze it all with all the data points you can imagine, 1,500 different chemicals, and then we have the microbiome, and that's also extremely sophisticated analysis because we are looking at multiple different types of bacteria and mold in the individual as well as in the home.
Melissa Bondi, even though we don't necessarily have all the answers yet, we have all of this data to look at with regard to Hurricane Harvey and public health impacts because, as you said, researchers and different organizations and communities came together quickly in the wake of Hurricane Harvey to put together this large research initiative. How unusual is that in the wake of this kind of natural disaster?
I think what we did was unusual because we rapidly got out into the community. We had many people contacting us and were concerned about what we were doing. And so we felt like it was important for us to get into the community so that we could, with people from our institution and others in the Texas Medical Center, so that we could try to learn about the health effects. So when this happens again, that we would be able to have information for others that might be suffering the same kinds of things. When we've been starting writing our papers right now, of course, we went back to the literature to see what was done. And actually, when we designed our questionnaires of the kinds of things that we would ask, we went back to what was published by other researchers and when those that studied the effects of Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, there was questions that we were able to ask that were similar so that we would be able to compare our results. But they didn't do exactly the same kinds of things that we did. We were concerned about the mold. We were concerned about personal exposures. But what's important for us is that we keep going back into the community to give them our results. We just completed focus groups to kind of find out what it was personally that affected them the most and what they would do to change what they did for Harvey for the next time. And so those are the kinds of things that we're compiling right now through the focus groups and also talking to them about what's important and what is it that they want to learn from what we've done. So there's been a lot of dialogue between our participants and us, and that was why we decided to do the symposium and invite the participants and invite people that are stakeholders and policymakers so that we could really try to hone in on these kinds of problems. And our mayor is going to be coming, and Judge Ed Emmett, who was involved on the county side to really manage this disaster and did an incredible job. And so we want them to hear the results so that they can help make this situation the next time much better.
And we tend to think of events like this as fairly discrete and short term. We think about, you know, getting people back into their homes and back to daily life, and that's kind of the end of the story. But when you're talking about things like chemical exposures or exacerbation of asthma or certainly psychological trauma, those are very long-lasting impacts. These events aren't just, you know, 2 weeks and back to normal life.
Absolutely not. And many of these people are not back in their homes. And what's really sad is that people are living in homes that they were unable to repair because they didn't have insurance. And it's just really sad when we go back into the community and people are telling us that they're living in homes that have nothing in them, but they can't afford to fix them. And it's just, who knows how much mold is growing in the homes now, because I think they were able to take out maybe the sheetrock, but they're still living there without any of the repairs made, especially in some of these poor neighborhoods, and, you know, complaints about not able to get help. And those people that had insurance, they were able to recover faster, but they still have post-traumatic stress disorder when it comes to hearing about storms coming and what to do. And I think now our television's response there are, when we listen to the news when there's a hurricane or the potential thought of any high water or rain, people just freak. And it doesn't really matter if they're coming from the poorer neighborhoods or if they're coming from, you know, those where the water was released from the reservoir.
Melissa Bondi is professor of epidemiology and population sciences at Baylor College of Medicine. She's been studying the public health impacts of Hurricane Harvey. Melissa, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And it's always important for us to get the word out about the devastating effects of disasters. So thank you for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. An AI developer races against time to create a computer program that can save his son from the mysterious illness that seems to be killing him. It sounds like the premise for a science fiction novel, but it's a true story. Matthew Might is director of the Hugh Call Precision Medicine Institute at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. His son, Buddy, has a rare genetic disease, and this past May, he became extremely ill. Might put an experimental algorithm into action to come up with possible causes and treatments. It's a story that hints at how artificial intelligence could transform medical care. Matthew Might, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
When did you first sense that something was amiss for Buddy?
So it was Star Wars Day, and I had taken him to the Science Museum, and he was fine around lunch, but by dinner, he seemed to be having difficulty breathing. He's a medically complex child, but even by his standards, he seemed really labored, and something just wasn't quite right. So I said, yeah, we have to do something about this now.
Take us back before this. You mentioned that Buddy is, as you said, a medically complicated child. He has a genetic disorder that is quite possibly unique. So what is that disorder?
Yeah, the disorder is called NGLY1 deficiency or NGLY1 deficiency. And in fact, he was the first patient ever discovered with that disease. It is an extremely rare genetic disorder. He's still the only one with his genotype ever seen. But there are about 70 or so kids that have effectively the same missing gene as him that present similarly.
And how long did it take to diagnose Buddy with that illness from the time he was a baby and you were first noticing that, you know, he was not hitting developmental milestones perhaps the way he should have been?
So that was about a 4-year process back then. You couldn't just magically look in someone's genome at the time he was born, but it became available in the early years of his life through research studies. So we were able to look in his exome and find out that he effectively had this missing gene.
Hmm. Well, Matthew Might, at that point, your research was more in the area of cybersecurity, right? And you now lead a Precision Medicine Institute at University of Alabama. Was there one day when you just woke up and said, you know, I've got to use my computer skills to help my son? Or was it a more gradual transition?
It was a very gradual transition. So, yeah, by training, I'm an academic computer scientist. I spent most of my career doing, cybersecurity, programming languages, things like that. But at parallel, I was trying to solve this mystery of my sick child. And eventually, that personal passion became a professional passion. But it was a gradual process, and there were some step functions along the way. So I've actually been on the faculty at the Harvard Medical School for about 4 years and ended up doing a term of service in the White House on the Precision Medicine Initiative. So it was a process that pushed me over the line. Then eventually I went entirely full circle into precision medicine when I joined UAB.
So this past May, you're out with Buddy and he seems to be having trouble breathing. What happened once, you kind of got him to a doctor and tried to figure out what was going wrong?
So we got him to the ER. And they said, oh, this looks like septic shock. Almost immediately, they said, this looks like septic shock. And that freaked me out because I realized at that point he had about a 50% chance of survival just from that alone. And I'm a computer scientist by training, so I fired up an AI tool that I had built called Medicanron to start asking it questions about septic shock. And I asked things like, well, what causes septic shock? What does septic shock cause? And how do you treat it? And right away from that, I noticed something that was unique to his condition. The tool actually suggested using albumin as a potential treatment for septic shock. And that's important for him because every child with his disorder has low albumin by default, which further increased his odds of dying from septic shock. So I relayed that immediately to the treating physicians, and they immediately put him on albumin supplementation. And that may already have been the reason he even survived the very first night in the hospital.
Why, though, would you turn immediately to an artificial intelligence algorithm as opposed to just pulling up Google? Septic shock is a very dire condition, but it's not incredibly rare. you know, why did you immediately think, well, I need help from an artificial intelligence algorithm to deal with this situation?
I mean, a couple of reasons. One, personally, is I'm not a medical doctor. I have a PhD in computer science instead. So I don't have the background medical knowledge. But with this tool, I can acquire it pretty quickly. And so, for that matter, can anybody else. Secondly, this tool isn't like Google where, you know, you search for a term and it just shows you the pages that have that term. This tool actually reads those pages. And so it can understand whether or not the page or the paper it has read says something like, this is used to treat this condition. So I can ask it a very specific question, not just show me all the pages for septic shock. I can say, show me all the treatments for septic shock ever proposed by any paper anywhere.
And how was this algorithm originally developed, and why was it originally developed? Obviously, you did not write this in the span of 1 hour specifically to address Buddy's situation.
That's right. So this is a tool that we have been building at the Precision Medicine Institute at UAB for quite some time now. It's about a year and a half old at this point. And it's developed under a program at NIH through NCATS. It's called the Translator Program. And this effort is really trying to categorize and structure all of the biomedical knowledge out there anywhere into a format such that you can automatically reason about it. So we've been developing this tool as part of that program now for quite some time. And we're very lucky that I happened to have it on hand as he began this crisis.
That is, I think, perhaps a different model than many of us have in mind when we think about how artificial intelligence might be deployed in a medical setting. There's a lot of fear about the possibility of automating medicine. And what you're describing is more like an assistant to the physician, that AI is playing an assisting role. Is that how you imagine or envision AI moving into the medical setting?
Absolutely. I really see AI as more of a tool for medical enhancement, and, you know, enhancing the physician, giving them abilities that they didn't previously have, because ultimately it's really about that physician's clinical insight at the end of the day and what they choose to do for helping that patient. So I would never dream of getting rid of clinicians or physicians. I think that's a fantasy anyway. And it's what we really want to do is assist them, absolutely, and enhance them to the extent that we can. You know, imagine what you could do if you could give every physician rapid, deep access to the sum total of all medical knowledge. That's really what we want to do.
Well, Matthew Mite, your son's acute illness this past May was the first test run for Medi-Canron, and you said that it immediately popped up this one idea, perhaps giving albumin could help deal with what appeared to be septic shock. And the doctors took that advice readily, you said, and did give your son albumin. Did that work? Was that a success?
Well, that was really the beginning of a five-week odyssey. And just to clarify, we have deployed Medi-Canron plenty of times clinically over the past year, but this is really the first emergency use of Medi-Canron where it had to be done in real time. So the albumin helped on that first night, but that was the beginning of a five-week odyssey. And it was very difficult to figure out the cause of this what was clearly an infection. And after literally 3 weeks in, we still didn't know what was driving this infectious process. And so he was just fading more and more day by day. I mean, he'd even coded in the ICU at one point. And I honestly thought he was going to die. And that's really when I said, wait a minute, I'm sitting on this tool, all this knowledge. Why don't I write an extension for it that could try to predict what he has, what this infection really is? So it was over Memorial Day weekend. I sat down in the chair next to his bed and literally in one day wrote a tool that could harness the data that we use to predict treatments to predict potential diagnoses for Bertrand. And it came up with a short list of potential organisms that could be driving this. I think there are about eight different suggestions on the list. And then I started working with, you know, infectious disease here to start ruling out which ones it could actually be or not be. And then to rule things out even faster, we also employed metagenomics. So I partnered with Sean Levy at Hudson Alpha to do ultra-rapid sequencing of Bertrand's blood and pleural fluid to look for fragments of pathogenic DNA, basically DNA from organisms like Pseudomonas or E. coli that could be causing an infection like this that were floating around inside of Bertrand, which might indicate what this really was. And by combining the list we got from the AI with a set of organisms that came back from this, you know, ultra-rapid metagenomic sequencing, there was really one outlier that stood out, and that was Pseudomonas. There was even a specialized kind of virus called a phage, called a Pseudomonas phage, living inside Bertrand somewhere, eating the Pseudomonas inside of him. So that there were so many clues that were popping out saying this is what it is, so that 4 weeks in, he finally, I mean literally 24 hours after starting his treatment, he left the ICU and was on a regular pulmonary floor after being pretty close to dead the week prior.
Wow. Do you think it is realistic to think that this is something that could be scaled and could become the norm within our medical system?
I absolutely do. And in this case, the economics are in our favor. So the AI part, that's cheap and free. We release Medicanon for free. Anybody can reach out to us and we can run queries for them if they want. And then when it comes to the ultra-rapid genomic sequencing, that's not necessarily cheap, but compared to the cost of an ICU stay, it's honestly trivial. So if we could shave even a few days off an ICU stay, it would pay back pretty fast.
Matthew Mite, you, as you already mentioned, advised President Obama on a precision medicine initiative. Where does Medicanron and this sort of artificial intelligence fit into the broader picture of precision medicine and the future of medical care?
So I think, yeah, Medicanron and AI in medicine more generally are on the near-term implementation side for precision medicine. So I define precision medicine as the use of data to optimize health. And in order to do that, you know, you have to be able to make sense of all the data that's out there and all the data that you can collect on a patient. And tools like Medicanron are the kind of tool that can do that. They can help you make sense of this mountain of data available outside and within a patient to focus it in the direction of a diagnosis and predict a potential treatment. So I think this is cutting edge near term for the implementation of precision medicine. And it's the kind of thing that we're taking very aggressively into the clinic here at UAB. So we're moving this program, which is a research program right now, into the health system as we speak.
It's literally happening right now.
That's right. It is happening right now.
How is Buddy doing today?
Well, he's much better. It was a 5-week hospital stay, so it took a lot out of him. And he's already a pretty fragile kid. So he's not back to where he was pre-admission. He lost like about a third of his weight even. But, you know, he's happy. He's been reunited with his pet fish, which brings him a lot of joy. And today was, in fact, his very first day of sixth grade. So he was very happy to be back in school.
Well, congratulations on that, certainly. And best wishes to you and to Buddy.
Oh, thank you.
Matthew Mite is director of the Hugh Call Precision Medicine Institute at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, how media coverage of climate change varies from country to country. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. How an issue is portrayed in the media can have a huge effect on how it's perceived by the public. When it comes to climate change, a lot of attention has been dedicated to how much the issue is covered and whether that coverage is scientifically accurate. Now, a new analysis of more than 37,000 articles from 45 countries around the globe suggests that a key factor in how climate change is covered is economics, the country's per capita GDP specifically. Wealthier countries are more likely to emphasize domestic politics and the scientific evidence behind climate change, while media in poorer nations tend to focus on the impacts of climate change and the need for international policy solutions. Hong Tian Vu is an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Kansas and the lead author of that new study. Welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with how you would even do a study like this. I mean, 37,000 articles. How do you find and gather them, and how do you analyze them? Hopefully this is not you reading 37,000 articles about climate change.
Oh, no. We didn't really read individual articles, but it took us a while to actually download all the data from different databases. We look at three different kind of databases and also newspaper websites to download all the news stories that had climate change in the lead or in the headline.
Hmm. And why go to this kind of effort? I mean, it seems natural to assume that just like climate change impacts and climate change policies vary from place to place, that climate change coverage would vary from place to place. why is it important to understand and document those differences?
Oh, we've been talking about climate change for quite a while now. Actually, climate change has become an important issue in the public discussion for the last 30 years. But we have to acknowledge that we haven't done really well in terms of communicating climate change to the public. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to look at more a global perspective, because climate change is a global issue. It's going to affect every country in the world. And no single country can claim that we are not going to be affected by climate change. So that is why we want to approach this with a global perspective, looking at how people might receive different kind of information to the news media channel about climate change.
I think, Hung Vu, the most shocking thing to me about the results of your analysis is that looking across 45 countries, as we said, tens of thousands of articles, that you found no place that tends to frame climate change as an immediate problem requiring national level policy. How can that be? How can nobody be talking about it in these terms of immediate need for national policy?
I think that because climate change has been portrayed as a very distant issue, something that we cannot control. So most of the time, the media has failed to portray it as an urgent issue that we need to deal with now. And that is a big concern for scientists in general. And for many countries, because of these priorities, they may portray climate change as an issue of other people, like somebody else's issues, not my issues.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that, because certainly I hear from climate scientists and those who study public opinion about climate change in the United States, I hear that all the time, right? That Americans don't view climate change as a here and now problem, or maybe they're starting to, but they haven't typically. They viewed it as somebody else's problem. But it's interesting to hear that those somebody else's also aren't viewing it as their problem. They're viewing it as somebody else's again.
Exactly. And this is also in my research agenda. We are now looking at what kind of messages that we are seeing every day about climate change, not just on the news media, but also on social media. What kind of messages in terms of impact, what kind of impact that we are seeing in those messages, whether the impacts are very relevant to us, close to us, whether it's local, national, or global. So we look at different aspects of climate change in messages by nonprofits, organizations, and also news media as well.
Well, Hung Vu, let's dig into what you are finding some of those messages are in the news media around the world. Also interesting to note that richer countries, those with a higher per capita GDP, tend to frame climate change as a political issue. And again, that's very familiar here in the United States, where we know we have this very polarized partisan public debate about climate change, about climate science, not just climate policy, but to hear that that's a broader phenomenon in wealthy countries, not just a U.S. phenomenon.
Exactly, because they really have to look at what kind of resources should be allocated to fighting climate change. And that would kind of start the debate about whether or not we should have this kind of policy, whether or not we should adopt this kind of law in order to curb greenhouse gas. And that has a lot of a political aspect into it as well.
Obviously, how many resources, what types of resources are available to deal with climate change is going to be a pressing debate in poorer countries as well. What's different about the framing of the climate change issue in the media in those countries?
So the media in general tend to follow the priorities of the nation, right? So in poorer countries, for example, people are still thinking about, what am I going to eat today? A lot of people are still dealing with more sort of like urgent issue that would affect their life. So that is why climate change, something is very distant, could be like the least priority for the country. So they don't really have the kind of resources to think about it right now.
And yet at the same time, here in the United States, we tend to hear how in some of those countries, climate change is perhaps one of the most pressing threats to food production, how droughts or floods are displacing people from their homes and causing food shortages. It might, to us here in the United States, seem surprising that, in fact, climate change isn't ranking higher on the list of priorities.
You are absolutely right, because climate change is happening, and it has happened for quite a while. And if we don't do that, we are going to see more pressing problems like you just mentioned, like food, immigration, conflicts in the world. And certainly it's going to affect the United States for sure, because with the accelerating globalization, we cannot avoid those problems.
Hung-Vu, it's interesting you mentioned that the media trends tend to reflect or follow the social and political priorities of a country. Now, obviously, media news coverage is reporting what is happening and what people are saying, so it has to reflect that in some way. But we also tend to think of the media as shaping those public discussions. Can you, in this analysis and in your work, start to untangle the chicken from the egg, the cause from the effect? I mean, is the media coverage influencing how climate change is viewed and how it's reacted to, or is it really just reflecting what's already there?
So we didn't really look at the effects of the news coverage on public opinion in this particular study, but there have been a lot of studies that look at that, whether what kind of messages that people are exposed to, whether or not it would motivate them to act on climate change. So there has been scientific evidence that if you portray climate change in certain light, people will not feel motivated.
Mm-hmm. Hung-Vu, you've said that this analysis is really looking at the framing of climate change coverage in different countries, not necessarily putting a spin on it, but just kind of what lens the media is bringing to their coverage of climate change. I wonder if you looked at all at the scientific accuracy of that coverage, because that's something that has gotten a lot of attention, at least in the United States. Is the media portraying the reality of climate change accurately in these different places?
So we didn't really look at or compare the portrayal in the media and also scientific evidence to find whether or not the portrayal is accurate. But there have been studies out there that prove that sometimes the media portray climate change inaccurately. For example, like a recent study that I have read said that the media tend to portray climate change as an unsettled issue, an issue that is still in debate. Why, overwhelmingly, you could see that scientists agree that climate change exists, and we agree that what causes climate change. But the media tend to focus on the conflict aspect, the balance norm that could affect how climate change is presented in the news.
Is that true around the world, or is that just an American phenomenon?
I think it's more or less in developed countries where people and different actors trying to influence the news media in certain way.
Hung-Vu, based on what you've done now, this data set that you have and the trends that you have found in differences between wealthier and poorer nations and how they frame climate change, where do you go with this next? What kind of questions does that raise for you?
So the question that we are interested in now is about, like, what kind of messages that would help motivate people to take action. And we're looking more at also at global perspective, and we are investigating the nonprofits, organization communication on climate change. So we look at different countries. We also want to compare the differences between richest and poorer countries and see what we also wanted to answer the questions like, how do we best communicate climate change so that people will understand it, people will take action to fight against it?
Hung Tian-Vu is an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Kansas studying media framing of climate change around the globe. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.